Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Kostura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 20th, 2026. All right, Tom, I know we kind of have a slightly different format for this because I got a big report I wanted to chew through, which I thought was a kind of some fun talking points. So we'll kind of let you go and jump into your two finds first, and we'll kind of walk through those. That way we have a lot of time to chew on the other stuff I've got to talk about.
Yes.
So good. What do you got for us?
All right. So I'm going to start off. The first one this week is an article from Elastic Security. It's titled "Phantom in the Vault, Obsidian Abused to Deliver Phantom Pulse Rat." So Elastic describes a social engineering campaign tracked as REF-6598 that abuses Obsidian's legitimate community plugin ecosystem as the initial access mechanism rather than relying on a traditional software exploit. So anyone that's not familiar with Obsidian, it's basically, it's like a note-taking app that has a lot of capabilities, a lot of different embedded workflow plugins and different things you can do to make it highly functional. So kind of along the lines of a Notepad plus plus kind of thing, I think, with more ties to more modern kind of functionality as far as like tagging and notebook style stuff. But it's a common app. A lot of folks use it. It's available, you know, for Windows, Mac, etc. The intrusion depended on user trust and workflow abuse. So victims were given attacker-controlled Obsidian sync credentials. They were told to connect to a shared vault and instructed to enable community plugin sync. So the attacker-defined plugin configuration could then execute automatically when their vault was opened. The campaign was cross-platform. So on the Windows side, the chain led to Phantom Pool and then the Phantom Pulse Rat. On Mac OS, it used a multi-stage Apple script-based chain with launch agent persistence and fallback C2 discovery using Telegram. You know, this article kind of matters because it kind of shows how a signed, trusted application can become an execution and persistence channel simply through just leveraging its capabilities like synced JSON, plugin configurations, and so on. But the kind of the core focus point that I take out of this one is really thinking about that parent-child process telemetry and how that associates beyond living off the land stuff and looking at like onboarded apps and how they can be manipulated and what normal might look like for, you know, something you might have that you might not consider that parent-child process relationship. So there's kind of an overall overarching my viewpoint on this one as I kind of go forward. So let's talk about some of the technical highlights here. So the attackers have used Obsidian community plugins, specifically shell commands and hider. Elastic had found the malicious configuration under the synced vault path, user documents, the vault name, Obsidian plugins, Obsidian-shell commands. And then you had your JSON file kind of drop there with execution tied to plugin triggers like startup and vault open on the app. The initial Windows clue was legitimate Obsidian EXE spawning suspicious PowerShell. So there's kind of our first hit of a suspicious parent-child. Elastic confirmed the process creation originated from Obsidian itself, not a masqueraded binary or a third-party DLL sideload or any type of malicious file replacement. So Obsidian does offer the functionality to do various automation things, but it is relatively non-standards. It tends to be leveraged that way by more advanced users. The threat actor here, or the threat here, was taking advantage of that capability. So this kind of comes again to that whole parent-child process piece and maybe kind of understanding how certain apps beyond Mobins work in your environment. So the stage one Windows command used Base64 wrapped invoke expression to download and then run a second stage PowerShell script. What we see in this command is some of your typical stuff. These are pretty, you know, kind of common hunting focus pieces here, where you see the invoke web request call going out to a specific IP to pull down that PowerShell script. You see it calling that script and then running an execution of that script, bypassing the execution policy, running with a Windows style hidden, you know, commonalities for suspicious PowerShell usage. The second stage PowerShell that is imported It also brings along bits transfer. So it downloaded a exe called syncobs exe, so syncobs, to the temp folder, and then sent operator facing status updates via invoke rest method post. The Phantom Pulse also used WinHTTP for their base C2 communications, and it also carried along a blockchain back C2 resolution. So the malware queried block scout APIs for Ethereum, Base, and Optimism transaction data tied to hard-coded wallets. It decrypted the latest transaction input, accepted it as the active C2 if it carried within those transaction notes starting with HTTP. So Elastic also documented that the C2 endpoints for telemetry, tasking, upload results, and keylogging also included ability to drop commands, include additional inject, screenshots, keylog, uninstall, elevate, all kinds of nasty stuff. That's on the Windows side. So we're looking on the Mac side. The shell commands plugin launched a Base64 decoded payload again, but they did it through OSA script. The chain created was under the library launch agents, and then a dropped plist file that contained a keep alive and run at load. And then it executed an obfuscated Apple script using bash, bash-c pipe to the OSA script. The macOS dropper checked hard-coded domains, then fell back to scraping specific for backup domain. And then it retrieved its second stage, similar to the PowerShell second stage. In this case, it retrieved the second stage just using curl and piping it to OSA scripts. So nothing that is necessarily crazy or novel here. I think the use of Obsidian does say a lot, and I thought it was a good conversation point to bring up, Scott. And again, I'm going to echo things I've already said about 3 or 4 times, but really considering those parent-child processes, there is a lot in this article. I think I picked out a tag, something like 6 or 7 different specific types of hunts you can go after, but there's also some things to consider with that parent-child process, right? So with Obsidian being a pretty common app that's used, you should be able to baseline that relatively simply. And looking for some of those suspicious processes, like on the Windows side, it's spawning PowerShell, or maybe even spawning command line, or, you know, even higher signal. If you see Obsidian kicking off WScript, Cscript, MSHTA, things like that, it at least throws suspicion. On the Linux side, similar idea, you know, maybe Obsidian, the Linux or Mac side, it's launching bash as a child, or sh or zsh osa script, all those things. I think something else that I kind of pulled out of there too is maybe considering ideas for hunting that Obsidian shell command plugin being dropped into the artifact. So it's really looking at that file creation, although I haven't done a whole lot of research on the kind of static existence of that versus it being some kind of a potentially rotating more IOC categorized thing. So that's just kind of a surface thought. But yeah, Scott, ultimately, I thought that was the point out of this article. There's a lot there for hunters. I thought it was written pretty well, and there's a lot to take out of it pretty easily. You see a lot of sample commands, things going on, snapshots, a lot of detail to go hunting for behaviors. And really, yeah, it was cool to see that topic of a common app just being leveraged as it's built. That's not a traditional lull bin that attackers leverage to do what we see traditional lull bins being leveraged to do. So yeah, what are your thoughts, Scott?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite parts about this is seeing basically the same attack happening in parallel, like the Windows versus the Mac, and how it looks different, but also is kind of implemented the same, just using whatever native tools are there. So I think it's a great way for people to wrap their head around, like, well, I understand how attacks happen on Windows and what's common there. And this is a great way for you to compare and say, okay, so if I understand those on Windows, and here's the equivalent, right, for things to look for and how things are achieved in a different operating system. So that part I really liked. The other thing that I haven't really looked into much that I thought was kind of cool is I don't think I've ever seen or the call stack that view in Elastic. Now, it says Elastic Alert, so I'm guessing there had to be an alert for it to generate, so it's not like on every execution. I don't know, because sometimes there's some words that are mentioned in here that I don't, they kind of confuse me. Like, for instance, when they talk about like the API calls being hashed, and then they provide the key to like reverse them so they can dynamically. I'm like, well, hashing technically isn't reversible, so it's really encryption, even though I know the function call has hash in it in the name. So that's why I wasn't sure if that was just a language thing or not. But great examples of how PowerShell is used to download things. They even use a few different methods. They do the invoke web request, but they also use bitsadmin. So you can see how being like doing your research and understanding the behavior overall than trying to like point in time address it. It's good to like look at, well, how do you or download things with PowerShell? There's obviously two ways here. There's two other ways technically that you can leverage it as well. So there's those pieces. The process execution, as far as like the parent, you've got CMD, you got mixed in there. Same way they're kind of using Bash on the Mac OS side. And then obviously the use of curl and tools like that on the Mac side. You know, there's some obvious things there. And then I don't know if I heard you mention it because I was kind of reading along while you were talking, but, you know, the use of cryptocurrency, right, for the C2 calls, right? Like that's becoming more common because I think it's just becoming easier. But also, I also feel like it's still a fairly trivial thing if you have that network style data for web requests to know that like that's just, you know, odd behavior, right? Granted, if you're attacking people using Obsidian, you're probably not necessarily attacking organizations directly. You're attacking people who are probably employed that maybe use Obsidian in their own personal space. But I think that's a big thing because we'll kind of talk to the report I'm gonna talk later. Like credentials are just a thing now that make it, and how those are getting picked up in so many different ways is making kind of attacks a little different as far as how you deal with them, because it's not just a, hey, I broke in. It's more that I was just let in kind of approach. So yeah, there's a lot of good nuggets. I did notice that, they had a executable, I'm trying to figure out, but it had two characters instead of one. So obviously an active listener, the attacker is to our podcast, because how much I harp on that. So I feel like that was a slap to the face to me a little bit.
Signal.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the PowerShell. It was a TT.PS1. So, you got me there, but yeah. So like a lot of the same things we kind of call out, I think are worth paying attention to, because this is a great example that has multiple stages throughout. That use a lot of the mechanics that we talk about weekly when we do this. So yeah, it's kind of a confirmation. But like I said, I think the best part is just that tangent, looking at Mac side by side with Windows for a similar attack chain.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah, because you typically don't see that, right? So most of the threat info reports we see, it's either focused on one or the other. You don't see a lot of that kind of overlap. So it's nice when you do, so you can run that comparison and understand the environments better.
Right.
But still, I mean, theory and execution-wise, they're pretty related in the paths of what the adversary is considering or thinking through.
Yeah, awesome. I guess the other thing I want to mention is there's a lot in there getting up to the point of the malware, and then they kind of talk about like, oh, here's some of the capabilities, right? And that's kind of how I think about a lot of the malware per se. Is I'm more interested on everything leading up to the point of infection, because those help validate methods that can lead to other infections, not just that malware. Sometimes when people get really heavy-handed on focusing on, well, there's this malware that does these things, look for these things, then I feel like your hands are more tied to, you're not going to find as any extra things when you I guess sharpen your tools for that malware specifically. So I love how that's the lead in for this is kind of like leading up to how everything gets deployed and sustained. And then they kind of talk on it versus focusing intently on, oh, they were social engineered and they got dropped, and then to go through the malware thing, right? So I like the layout as well.
Yeah, 100%. The psychology stuff inside of Intel reports, and maybe that's worth us diving into in a future show more, but the snippets and the tidbits that you can get from that portion of a given Intel, especially if you understand as it leads into the technical pieces, where else they could go, right? So if you were threat hunting or building a detection, leveraging that context, because I know it's easy to kind of skip through to what commands were ran, what are the artifacts, right? Mm-hmm. Which isn't bad, right? Because you want to get right to operationalizing it. But if you have the ability to understand that context, it's going to allow you to consider future-proofing whatever thing you're trying to do, right? Whether you're developing a more advanced hunt or you're putting in a detection that's going to just live there. If you consider that context, you can future-proof it. So it has less holes, right?
Yeah, and most attacks aren't super novel. So if you learn from those parts, then you know those parts are going to be repeated or learned from somewhere else.
Even if they weren't specifically done yet. Right. There's an avenue for them. Yeah.
Cool. So, okay. What do you got for us now?
Second one for this week from my side. So, this is an article from ESentire. It's entitled STX Rat, a new rat in 2026 with InfoStealer capabilities. So, STX Rat is a newly observed remote access Trojan with integrated InfoStealer functionality that's targeting Windows systems for credential and data theft. It combines traditional RAT capabilities, so you know, your remote control, your persistence, and so on, but it also adds and brings in the browser credential harvesting and system recon capabilities. So it applies an emphasis on stealth through leveraging in-memory execution and AMSI bypass techniques to really help evade those endpoint detections. It seems that it's likely intended for a broad or potential broad post-compromise access, really enabling both like kind of that espionage and follow-on payload and so on. And it really kind of highlights a trend of commodity malware adopting advanced defense evasion techniques that you kind of typically see more in higher end threats. So some of the technical highlights here, there's nothing abnormally novel here, but it is worth pointing out. The initial execution commonly involves user-triggered payloads with deceptive naming. In particular here, we do see the use of double file extensions. So you're like .pdf, .exes, .lnk, .pdf type things. Been seeing those more as of late. Last couple months, that seems to be a little bit of a thing that I guess from just my personal observation seems like a trend line to consider. It writes stage payloads to disk using the short or, here you go, Scott, single character file names with executable extensions to, you know, blend in the system, blend into the noise of the systems. It executes PowerShell for staging and execution. It includes the encoded commands. It implements AMSI bypass using that AMSI ghosting technique that patches that RPCRT call. Basically eliminating the AMSI inspection flow. It hides the execution in Windows immediately after launch, so the user can't see what's going on, puts the window in the background, accesses browser credential stores to extract those, say, passwords, session data, and so on. It establishes persistence by the most talked about way possible in the registry run key, and then maintains a traditional, you know, C2 communication. So nothing overwhelmingly out of line here. The biggest point that I brought up that I thought was the takeaway out of this is one, easy to hunt for, right? So something that's had impact and can, I lost my notes there, sorry. It's had impact and very recently been successful in what it's accomplished. It's using techniques that are tried and true. It's using things that have high telemetry and are easy to go after, even though the article does go through talking about how there's execution and memory capabilities, and it tends to try to strive for that. So Annoyed basically seems like it's going to evade those initial detections, and then it's going to find a way to keep itself hidden by launching and executing in memory. But there's a ton of artifacts here, your registry run key for persistence, your access to browser credential stores. You see some of those kind of potentially suspicious parent-child processes, things that are, you know, different scripts or different files that are executing and launching PowerShell and so on. There's a ton here. The double file extension, single character file names. There's a lot of really, really straightforward stuff to hunt for. But I thought that point that the article really tried to wrap itself around is that this is labeled in a bit of a commodity malware, and some of the techniques that are being used here, like the AMSI ghosting, right? But I think typically we only seen that from big players before. If I think back over the course of the last year, we have seen that technique being used, but it's usually by, you know, some of the people that are in the top 10, groups that are in the top 10 that we're constantly hearing about that are highly active, even APT side. So it's just something to think about, that some of that trickle down that always happens, that frankly I don't know if we talk about enough, Scott, where bigger groups or bigger APT adversaries, or, you know, whatever you want to put in that bucket of the upper echelons of the adversaries, their techniques find their way to the flow downstream, and they become normal use by adversaries coming up or new groups or what have you. So a lot of good stuff to hunt for here. I thought the article was pretty solid. And yeah, just wanted to share, kind of remind Chase the tried and true. And also, it's worth paying attention to that context piece, right? I think this kind of echoes into that. I didn't even plan on that, Scott, but that context of what is being told inside of the article can be adapted and understood. So, you know, we can look at it more effectively later, because this stuff's trickling downhill.
Yeah, no, and this is a great thorough write-up too, as far as how much detail they include, which I like. And clearly the attacker is not a listener, because of the persistent use of single characters for the bin and for the text file, which is okay. Those are the ones that we'll be able to target first with our hunt.
Let's say banking them all. Check, we got to change our demographic.
Yeah. But you know, it's always interesting, because seeing bin files hit Windows systems, I think it's just like an interesting nuance of, you know, they exist, but they're not like as common as, or should be that common, I would say. So that's also an interesting, when you see like weird file extensions, sometimes can be an odd behavior. But yeah, there's like you mentioned, a lot of the classic things. I do like the fact that they talked about how even the bin file, it contained the payload, it was reversed and then base64 encoded, right? If I read that correctly. So that's just an interesting way to obfuscate even further, because there are a lot of tools that will read base64, right? EDRs and things like that can, you know, read base64 and then do their analysis. And I thought that was like an easy, quick trick to avoid some of that. There's one other thing that really caught my eye. Now I'm starting to blank on it. Oh, that's what it was. I needed to apologize based on that hashing API thing, because this article did a much better job of explaining it. And then I went back and kind of looked at the hashing before. When they have the hashed API calls, so they get dynamically looked up for, you know, what they're actually doing is they'll look up what's actually loaded in the PEB for what's in memory, and then run the same hashing algorithm on those, then see where they match. And that's how they dynamically look up where the address is for. So the API is never actually exposed at all. It's just doing here's our table of hashes from the pre-hashed values that we have compared to what it's able to enumerate in memory and hash the same way, so they can have the same value, which makes a lot more sense now that I understand it that way, right? It's a way where now nothing can do like string matches, right? When you run strings on files, or even, you know, I'm assuming EDRs do something similar if they wanted to, where they can pull out those key names like virtual alloc and stuff like that, that you see when you do like memory injected attacks, you'll never see those API calls with this type of method. So yeah, it's that part's pretty cool. So I just want to call that out, as well, but you kind of addressed a lot of the common things that we typically see. And this one's pretty good. They get into a lot of the detail as far as like even the assembly code level stuff, which is always kind of interesting, because I always want to get better at actually looking at those things, but it's not something that I've done in like live practice for anything. I just like understanding it better. And this one also has a really good list of like, artifacts for things to be aware of. Like, they talks about how they do their anti-VM detection stuff. I think this stuff's always really good to be aware of. And somehow if you're able to set up how things actually will ping off these artifacts, because if something's trying to read registry keys that don't exist but are tied to VMs or specific files, trying to locate those, especially if it's using lolbins for that, you can key off some of the similar activity and know that, well, there's nothing natively that's going to probably look for these types of things unless it's something landing in an environment that's it's not aware of and likely malicious, right? So that's where I think these lists are great, just so that, you know, you kind of know what things will be looking for. So you can kind of set those, you know, quote unquote traps. So that part was pretty good too.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, simple, definitely useful for hunters, and recommend anyone take a look at it. It's a good article. A lot of meat and potatoes there. But all right, Scott, that's my two. So you want to dive into your big report?
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes we hit on some big reports and we don't go too deep, or we just pick out some things. This one I really liked because it's called A Defender's Guide from the Frontlines. So, and it's from Sentinel One, but it's their annual threat report. But they're, what I like is they talk about some of the common problems we've talked about routinely here, right? So there's no problem in here that we haven't touched on before. And it's always interesting from a vendor that has a security solution, and it's not just a, well, if you buy our tool, then you'll be safe, right? They don't take that approach. They take the approach to kind of how we think when it comes from like even threat hunting in itself. Like, we're looking at behaviors. You've got to understand enough about your environment and enough about the attacks themselves to be able to pick up on them. And so the first section they kind of talk about is the identity paradox, is what they call it. And this is just basically that there's been so many ways to steal credentials that a lot of attacks nowadays are leveraging legitimate user credentials. So it's not like, hey, we exploited this and got in kind of thing. And this is a lot harder for defenders to go against, right? Because now you're not really paying attention to the login. You're kind of paying attention to post login activities. And even when it comes to Insider, they bring that up, right? Y'all are familiar with the DPRK, with like the known IT worker, you know, fake employee, but they get hired and they get access. Now that access, now you have like someone basically inside that has legitimate credentials, right? That's kind of an interesting front for how credentials were being harvested, or access was being gained, right? But they also, there's a lot of reverse proxy phishing sites, which is an interesting way to attack, where you'll phish somebody and it will proxy the attack to the legitimate site. And that's how they're able to basically steal session cookies, as another method for having legitimate access, right? Even though session cookies may not persist for an indefinite, like, you know, infinite amount of time, those are things that you kind of have to pay attention to. So after all the sections, they have these challenge for the defender kind of thing. But that was when the first one was like monitoring for that post-authentication deviations. I think that's big. Like, we always talk about behaviors, but this isn't as simple as, hey, this is the behavior you need to look for, go find it. It's about understanding like those common behaviors in your environment, whether it be, when do people typically work, as far as like a bulk of that, when, what do people typically do in different groups of job roles, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Or is there like an increased number of failed access after they're already authenticated to things, right? Like, there's different ways to look at that problem. I don't know, we've talked about that in the past, trying to solve similar things, right? So I thought that was a good call out for that. And then one of the things that happens a lot too is if someone does get valid credentials, even in, when there is multi-factor, is they are, attackers are very good at enrolling their own devices, right? Either unenrolling the device that's assigned to the real user and then adding theirs, or just adding theirs outright because one hasn't been added. So that's a whole nother thing that people should really be paying attention to. That was a big thing with identity paradox, that I thought was worth calling out. And then they talk about some like auditing and workflows. And that's another thing. Like we talk about knowing yourself. I think auditing is just as important. Like I always call them like profiling or like discovery hunts. Like if you don't have something specific to hunt for, you should be hunting for like, how does this work in my environment? Or what does this look like from a data perspective? Whatever this is, right? It could be a process. It could be a user, a level of a user, a service account, application, right? Those are always good to just know. So yeah, before I jump to the next section, and Tom, I don't know if I'll give you opportunities to jump in here. But the identity paradox, what are some of your like takeaways in general based on the things that I've said or touched on?
So this one always like lives in my mind because I feel like it's almost like over the course of time spent kind of in the field, this one has grown with this really like vivid picture of like, you know, start to finish, like the history of where I feel like it's almost like an unfinished hunt in my mind all the time. So when we think about that thing, like the session hijacking, right? There are ways to go about finding it, but it really does, as you mentioned, require that kind of baselining, that kind of understanding what the hell's going on in your environment. Like what is happening? Like, you know, how often are these users initiating MFA? You know, there are some tools like, you know, I know for sure, like the Microsoft side, they do have like, you know, location mismatches. So if there's some activity that happens from different places, there's things that can flag there if you're paying attention to them. But I always wonder if there's a better way to go after this that just requires more kind of individual to your environment building of what you want to kind of like trigger on. Because why I say that is I think it's very important because we see this more and more. And the session hijacking thing has just gotten more like that kind of history of this topic over the last 10 years has dramatically shifted into the place where it's not about stealing your creds or you know, jacking your username and the hash, like it's simpler now. You're getting active sessions, you're stealing tokens, you're pulling API keys that are hard coded in code. They're doing really simple stuff, so it almost feels like it's easier to get access now, than ever before. And so that makes me think it's like, you know, we haven't completely circled around what we need to do to protect this. So in my head, it's like this unfinished hunt. Like I think I'd want to attack it somehow where I can just start baselining what my users do, create some kind of triggers around what's outside of that norm, use a little bit of statistical analysis on that. Nothing crazy. I think even a junior analyst can go dig into the logs and kind of start looking at what those numbers look like. Depending on the system you have and what telemetry you're using, you know, basic things like how often has an MFA auth happened? What types of things has a user given OAuth access to, you know, in different apps and things like that? Because these are ways that are being highly leveraged to hijack sessions. So all of that to say, this one's always in my mind every time we read about it, because I feel like us as an industry haven't really circled around a real way to attack this. It kind of feels like that, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked about like, the scaling of detections together, right? Like, so, you know, people always try to use priorities and we've tried to implement similar stuff to this, but you know, like you don't always want to chase the low priority stuff. So like someone logging in at like 8 PM may not be enough to be like, well, this is a full on investigation, but it is interesting to just say, hey, here's all these activities that we're not going to investigate, but we want to alert. So it's easier to filter and find, you know, said things. And then maybe you can then group those things together on some common thing. Like, okay, you have a user that logs in, you know, past a certain level or a certain time. It's okay. Low level alert. And then you see them, that user is now executing PowerShell and command prompt. Very low level things as well. But then you also see that now they have a login on a different host. Like, all those could be low level by themselves where you're like, man, it'd be really resource intensive. But then you have something that says, hey, if I see any of these things right in this like 1 hour window, like maybe now I want to add a little more scrutiny to it. So sometimes people worry about building detections and alerts to find bad versus just let's just build a collection of weird behaviors and then go from there. Right. And I feel like with identity stuff nowadays, that's kind of what would help solve that problem. But obviously it's kind of almost an over-engineering of a solution, but I still think it's a great way to use the data. So
100%.
But yeah, so the next one is when they really start talking about like the, you know, basically trusted tools. We talk about, you know, a lot of people will use our remote management tools. Attackers are commonly seen doing that, or they trick people to install things. And so that's nothing specifically new. The one thing that there was kind of like a lot of things happening in 2025 was the SEO poisoning against like IT utilities like PuTTY or SonicWall, Netix, Extender, RV tools, stuff like that. So, you know, that's kind of hard to necessarily pick up on. But sometimes if you know what admin tools people are using, there's ways to just say this is normal, this is not, right? But one of the things that I think it's a good call out, they talked about the masquerading stuff when you're looking at like tasks being named, like specific tasks or like registry run keys that have something that's like, oh, OneDrive reporting or something updater. You know, I think it's really good if you know, possible. Like that's why I like threat hunting, because it puts data side by side a lot of times. If you're like, hey, give me all the run keys that were created in the past, you know, week, right? Now, like I have like a list of things, and if there's duplicates, it kind of helps me make a determination of, oh, those duplicates don't look good, or those look normal, right? But when you have those one-offs, it becomes, well, what is this? But I mean, looking for those obvious things, I think, is a good step, right, to pay attention to. And that's kind of like, you know, also understanding your environment. What are some things that are normal in your environment that you expect to see? Sometimes you can even look at your own machine if you're, you know, working with an organization and say, well, what do I have? And just compare from there in some respects. But they also mention like, you know, PowerShell is the weapon of convenience, which I think is funny because we do see PowerShell. It's just, it's always being used just because it's really effective. And there's ways to kind of skirt not detecting it, but they call out some of the things we've mentioned, which is a set MP preferences, which is how you can basically configure Windows Defender and you can like basically disable it. But they also mentioned the Phantom Capture campaign, which is a way where they set it to the set PS readline option, which basically they're able to discard all the history. So forensically, it's hard to recognize what happened. But the one thing that I wasn't aware of, and I was kind of curious, I don't know if you've seen this at all, Tom, but they mentioned ThunderShell, which was basically a way to run PowerShell scripts through a renamed Python interpreter. And that was to avoid directly invoking PowerShell.exe. I'm assuming that that would negate any PowerShell logging because PowerShell.exe isn't being launched, which I thought was kind of an interesting way. Obviously, there's other weird execution going on that would highlight something odd going on, but I don't know if you've seen ThunderShell. I don't know if I remember seeing that or not this last year.
So not ThunderShell specifically. However, there was, you know, some masquerading stuff that we chased down over the last couple of weeks that, yeah, I mean, if you, even if you simply rename PowerShell to just hide it and execute from there, it's going to eliminate all that PowerShell script block logging. So even if you use the actual exe, you just rename it, all of the script block logging goes away, so you get blind to it. So I mean, it makes sense to me, and it's definitely something people should consider. I think I forget when, and I don't think we talked about it on the show. I think we talked about it internally, but that idea of kind of having, to me, this points out a topic, and I don't mean to branch away from your direction here, Scott.
Oh, you're good.
But the idea behind like that kind of hole is that if you are in a Windows environment specifically, but I guess you could, it could be in a other side if you're leveraging PowerShell, but PowerShell is kind of a critical space because it's used and leveraged so much, right? So having telemetry around that is so important. So when you kind of, you know, in my mind, a methodology that I would take as a hunter or inside of my environment is to really kind of make sure that I understand my critical pieces, the things that are really critical that I know are being leveraged heavily and I need to make sure I have telemetry, is considering where that telemetry faults. And in this case, like script block logging is so good, right? We know it, we use it, we work on it, we leverage it all the time. It's great logging, great telemetry. all you got to do is rename PowerShell and it turns it all off. It just goes away. So having some of those fail safes, like also, you know, considering some, you know, having Sysmon on board alongside of the script block logging, so you can catch some of that command line telemetry, some of the things that it's doing, maybe not the full depth, but you can still have the breadth of the common stuff that's being used and not just be blinded to it because I
you'll leave masqueraded like PowerShell, right? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So having that functionality, I think that, you know, this calls to that point. The Thundershell stuff specifically, I'm not sure of, but I'm imagining it walks the same line because I found it interesting that just simply renaming PowerShell completely breaks its ability to log just script block logging. So not surprised, but I guess I assumed that it had more depth of capability there than something that basic, right?
Well,
let alone if you bring in another interpreter, right?
And I've seen, you know, using PowerShell Core, which is like the latest, greatest, like some of the built-in detections, alerts, protections, whatever for PowerShell get bypassed because they're built around looking at PowerShell version 5. So it's just different, right? So, and that's kind of what they're like defensive stance, like diffusing administrative abuse is what they call it, right? It talks about monitoring service-based persistence. So like basically anything is created with the system-level privilege on a workstation, it's a service or task, like you should be looking at those things. We talked about the masquerading things, but the one thing they mentioned that I thought was interesting that I commonly, I guess, don't really look for, but I'm aware of them, is the hardened LSA registry keys. And this is like, I don't know, when people try to talk about their password policies and how they're going to enforce those, like one of the ways you can do that is you can build a custom DLL that will set all the really, you know, restrictive things you want to do with password control. So some third-party tools will provide this. Sometimes you can, you know, I think you can build it yourself. But they're like two registry keys. They're in the local machine hive system current control set, but it's the control LSA and there's the security packages and the notification packages. They usually have values like associated with what kind of authentication is allowed and some, you know, other type of base parameters, but they're usually like name things. They don't go back to a DLL, but if you see a DLL value, it's even more suspicious. But even name things usually will resolve to like a known DLL. But those are ways where people can actually like get in the middle and steal things. So they're interesting registry keys to pay attention to. Obviously, they talk about the whole like centralized logging and PowerShell logging we just talked about as a common thing. Always a great thing to do. But it's really about just kind of knowing how a lot of these high-level admin tools are, you know, being leveraged. So, yeah, then they go into... I'm not going to go too deep into this for time, but they talk about the, you know, the standard edge decay, right? We're kind of aware that there are going to be things that are hard to monitor because they're at the edge and the logging that's available. And these things have been used as beachheads in the past. It's just really about the big thing for them was knowing where those edge things talk to, right? Because you might not be able to see what's going on them necessarily, but if the communication is to be pretty consistent. And when that changes, it's pretty telling. So having telemetry like that is always really good. And then the living off the pipeline, this one has come up a lot lately, right? With the CI/CD pipelines. It's interesting because go into a lot of, hey, what if your developer pipelines get compromised, things you could be looking for. But usually, like, most people that are affected by this are the consumer side, right? And really, as the consumer of these different software packages and dependencies, it comes down to how does your app function? What does it talk to, you know, directly call out? Like, if you have a web app, I mean, those are pretty easy. It shouldn't be really talking back. It should just be responding, right? So when there's communication is going out from it in general, kind of weird. So just being aware of those types of things, I thought was, you know, pretty good callback. And then I won't really dive into the much else listed in here. There's some really interesting things, but just based on time, yeah, I don't want to necessarily read the whole report. But the... what I really liked about it, and I think it's worth looking at, is it just highlights how important it is to really know your environments understands where the problems are that other organizations are seeing and what attackers are doing, and then comparing that to, well, what do I know about my environment? How would that stand out, right? You almost have to be able to do that, like, subtraction of your environment from that activity. And if you can do that, that diff easily or not. Because if you can do it easily, you can build detections. If you can't, then you got to do threat hunts. And if you're going to threat hunt, what do you threat hunt on, right? And I think this whole report kind of calls out to that in many different ways. So it's a great, great thing to wrap your head around. So I'll kind of leave it with that passing comment, I guess. And then if there's anything you want to jump in here before we close out, you know, feel free, Tom.
One of the things that, like, and this is a hill I'm going to just live on, you know, this is becoming my single character file thing for sure, is there was a section in there, and there's some decent detail, but it talks about the living off the pipeline. So, you know, kind of angling towards that whole, you know, CI/CD pipeline, the developer space, the supply chain type stuff. It's something that I think, to be complete, this is just, again, my opinion, is still not being overstated enough. I think it's, honestly, it's being understated until we have different things. I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's just my observation. I'm curious what you think on that one, Scott, but the, that space, I think we need to pay attention to as hunters and defenders in general. Not when there's one-offs, but really starting to try to get ahead of it. So understanding your environments, trying to not be passive in a situation where you think, okay, well, maybe my company's not, like, out here heavy developing for blockchain space, or they're not heavy developing for X, Y, or Z, right? So maybe there's just internal development pipelines you have that stay inside of your environment. The tricks and the trades that are being leveraged that seem to be being adopted, the uptick in those behaviors across the variant breadths, not just coming from one space, not just coming from one, you know, nation state, not just coming from, you know, one ransomware group. You're seeing this unfold in real time. And I think we should consider some of the stuff and take information, like in this report, where we can, to really kind of look at some of those things, pull that context we keep talking about, and position yourself for some forward thinking. What does get developed in my environment? What kind of keys and API ties do I have? What is the normal traffic that's going out to specific places like GitHub or whatnot that's sharing tokens or leveraging tokens or CRUDs, or am I spinning up runners in my environment? Like, what is happening there? And I think it's still a bit of, at least, again, it feels like it's not being overstated, and it needs to be, that we just need to prepare and understand that. It worries me that we're in a reactionary state with this, when I think we have all the right tools. I think we have the right understanding. I don't think it's overwhelmingly complex, that we cannot be reactionary and start thinking on this one right now, proactive, because it's just going to continue to spiral, in my opinion. But I liked that piece was inside of the report. There was a little more depth in it than I expected, because I still feel like it's being under discussed. But yeah, that's just my one thing that I wanted to kind of pull on this from my side, Scott. And I don't know if you had any competing opinions there or not.
No, I think it makes sense. I mean, we see a lot of the same behaviors week after week, month after month. And it's like, if we were all looking at those behaviors consistently across the board, we would know attackers would change their behaviors. And the fact that they don't just amplifies that we don't consistently think about the problem as a whole. We think about the symptom sometimes, and that's what we end up addressing. So
yeah, that reactionary state and with threat hunting, because we tend to do somewhat, I mean, I think we angle more nowadays, especially when we consider behaviors, to go towards the proactive space. But there's enough out there that you can get stuff in your environment right now. You don't have to wait for it to occur to go chase it down. You can get protections, you can get stuff in place, you can hunt now, you can understand and baseline, like, consider the developer side of your environment if you have any, and just make sure you know what it is so you can effectively protect your environment. And I think more so because, and again, my opinion, I don't see this slowing down. I think we're going to see more of these types of incursions. Be positioned to react faster if you already know what your environment entails. And that's, I think, a big thing, especially with the supply chain stuff. I think your speed to reaction is even more paramount because of all the variant types of hooks that can happen from that, you know, just a simple node package or a simple Python package or library that it's just associated with these 1700 things. Like, you need to get an understanding of scale right away so you can properly mitigate, right? That's always part of the IR process. So yeah, it's all just worthwhile. I'm probably going to speak on this until people shut me off, honestly, because I think it's going to just be a thing and I want to see us get ahead of this one.
Absolutely. All right. Well, with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next time. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 20th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.